This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives. In the background, you can hear the Halcyon Quartet playing Haydn's Opus 74 No. 1, and it's the second movement. The reason they've played us into this podcast is because they're the musicians in residence at St. Sepulchre Without Newgate Church, the biggest church in the City of London. Unsurprisingly, the church has a musicians' chapel and strong links with the annual Proms concert series.
My name is Lydie Sinclair, and I'm the second violinist of the Halcyon Quartet.
And I'm Natalie Green Buckley, the violist of the Halcyon Quartet.
And we are the quartet in residence here at Holy Sepulchre, London. It's a beautiful place to work and perform, and you know, to have it at our disposal has been a really lovely thing.
And to be able to organise our own monthly concert series, it's been fab, getting rep together, and again, just to perform here, it's brilliant.
Do you choose the music that you play?
Yes, yep. Yes. Yeah. Very often it's a useful place to run things, take things for a test drive.
Generally here we've been trying to piece together different quartets and different movements because we're slightly less formal and we want people to fit, like they can walk out if they need to or arrive late.
Yeah, we try and make it like a time capsule. Mm. So today we had things ranging from 1700s and then mid-1900s, so we had a full range.
During the lunchtime concert that I listened to, Halcyon played music spanning many centuries. The church also spans many centuries. The Norman church was originally called St. Edmund, King and Martyr, and if you want to know more about him, tune into the St. Edmund, King and Martyr podcast. But over time, it's turned into St. Sepulchre Without Newgate. Without Newgate, because it stands outside the old New Gate. But there is no St. Sepulchre. It came to be so called due to its location. It stands outside the northwest corner of the city walls of London. And similarly, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre of Christ stands outside the northwest corner of Jerusalem city walls. And it's thought that knights returning from the Crusades recognised this similarity and started referring to it as the Holy Sepulchre Church. Jill Finch told me more about the history and associations of the church, and Alexandra Epps later told me about its windows.
It was rebuilt in the 15th century, and where we enter the church today, we still enter that 15th century porch, and the tower and the walls were pretty much all that was left after the Great Fire. Not rebuilt by Christopher Wren, rebuilt by people that the parish brought in. They couldn't wait for Wren, they wanted something to be done quicker than he was able to do it. And then, of course, you get the beautified, reorganised, bits added to it and redone in the 19th century as well.
So Wren didn't do it?
No. If you leave the church by the 15th century porch and turn left, you're heading towards Giltspur Street. Now, if you go up Giltspur Street and look to your left, you'll see what's called a watch house. Now, this is a 1962 rebuild of a much earlier watch house because it was put there to make sure that the body snatchers didn't come to St. Sepulchre's graveyard. Because just up Giltspur Street in West Smithfield, of course, is St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And the surgeons there and the students there always wanted cadavers to work on and learn on. So there was a pub called the Fortune of War, where the body snatchers would lay out their wares, waiting for the surgeons and the students to come over and buy them. But they didn't want them pinching them from the actual churchyard, so the watch house was put up there. It was destroyed during World War II, and it was rebuilt in 1962. We're coming into the porch now. And it is a rather beautiful groined vaulting 15th century porch. And there's one particular thing I want to show you just before we go into the church. So should we go through?
Let's go through.
We're inside the church now, but we haven't actually gone into the main area of the church. And I just wanted to show Catherine this font cover, wooden font cover. And there's a lovely story, a lovely little legend attached to this, that originally it was on a font at Christ Church, which is a little way down the road. Christ Church, of course, was very badly damaged by enemy action during World War II and not rebuilt. And the story behind this font cover is that apparently when the church of Christ Church was burning during the war, a postman came by, went in, rescued this font cover and brought it up to be looked after here in St Sepulchre's.
And it's rather sweet, actually. It looks a bit like a bell and
with an
angel on the top.
Yes.
Thank you for showing me that. I had totally ignored that every time I've been in. So we're now coming in through the door into the church.
And you can see Alex will be in her element because you can see lots and lots of stained glass. So she'll be talking you through all that. But just one thing, nobody can come into this church without knowing about this. So we're walking down the south aisle. We have what's known as the Newgate Execution Bell. Now, if you know your nursery rhymes, you know that oranges and lemons say the bells of St. Clemens. When will you pay me? Say the bells of Old Bailey. Now, for start, Old Bailey's a street, not a church.
Right. And Old Bailey is over the road, isn't it?
Yes. If you walk out of the church, cross the road, you'll come to Old Bailey. And the Central Criminal Court is there, and it's on the site of the old Newgate Prison. So the Central Criminal Court opened in 1907 when they finally closed down the prison. So the bells of Old Bailey were actually the bells of St Sepulchre. And there were two types of bells. There were the bells in the tower that would ring when there was going to be an execution outside Newgate. But this one was a little bit special. This is a hand bell. And there was a tunnel that led from the church under the streets into Newgate Prison. And the night before an execution, you can imagine, there were people already outside. It would have been like Harrod's sale, basically. There were people queuing outside to be at the front of the queue to see the execution, and they were usually in the morning. So the priest from St Sepulchre would go underground to get to Newgate Prison, and he'd have the handbell with him. Now, just in case that poor prisoner who was going to be executed the following morning had forgotten that that was going to happen, the man would ring a bell outside his cell, and he would say, "All you that in the condemned hole do lie, prepare you, for tomorrow you shall die. Watch all and pray, the hour is drawing near, that you before the Almighty must appear. Examine well yourselves, in time repent, that you may not to eternal flames be sent. And when St Sepulchre's bell in the morning tolls, may the Lord have mercy on your souls."
Oh, it's a horrible looking bell. There's nothing that appealing about this bit. It just looks functional.
And it was functional. It had a function.
It had a rather gruesome function. So there's lots of gory stories here. You've got the body snatchers, I suppose, digging up bodies because it was illegal.
What happened was, basically, at one time you could get hanged for so many things. So the surgeons and the students could use cadavers of murderers, convicted criminals. But then what happened was the crimes that you could actually be hanged for became less and less and less. They got more and more students in the hospital, so the need for cadavers was more. So this led to people actually killing people. And in fact, let's go back to that awful site over the road. There was a case, it was called the Italian Boy, and it was a young 14-year-old boy that was killed, and the gang who picked him up and killed him and tried to sell him to the surgeons, or his body to the surgeons, were actually hanged outside Newgate. 30,000 people came to see them hanged.
Oh, how awful, that poor little lad. We're not far from the execution bell. We're on the south side looking at one of the stained glass windows along here.
It's divided into three arches, and in the middle, at the bottom, we've got a picture of a ship called the Susan Constant. And just above that, we have a stained glass image of a man called Captain John Smith. And John Smith was a Londoner, he was a cordwainer, and he was the person who took the very first boats out to Virginia in 1607 to found the Jamestown settlement. He was, at that time, obviously going into Indian territory, Native American Indians over there. And he was captured. So there's this wonderful story about Pocahontas, the daughter of the chief of the local tribe, who kind of begged for mercy, got him freed. Actually, there was no romance between her and John Smith. But she did meet another man, and she actually married him, and he brought her back to England. But it wasn't really very nice, because in a way, she was like his advertising for the Virginia settlement. And basically, they dressed her up, they made her look lovely, they took her to events around London, and it was, you know, look what we can do with a savage. You know, this is where you should put your money. Mm. And she really, really wasn't very fond of John Smith, because he was telling rather tall tales around London about her tribe and her family and what had happened.
As well, wasn't he?
He's still got a window dedicated.
Yes, he has.
He's a fairy tale, isn't he?
He is, and this is the thing. Apparently Americans flock to this church and get a little bit annoyed when nobody can tell them exactly where he's buried, because nobody really knows. Just going back to poor old Pocahontas, yeah. She was here for about 9 months. She was going back home. She got as far as Gravesend, and she died just before she got on the ship. But it's not a... No, should we find a happy story?
And she doesn't feature there,
No, she doesn't, no.
The window is beautiful, though, isn't it? It's post-war. I think it's 1968, but it's a wonderful explosion of colour and pageantry and detail. It's by an artist called Francis Skeat. If you look at Smith himself with all his navigational instruments around him, and then the architectural views behind the figures, and then all the heraldry and the boats, it's a real draw, I think, this window for people. And what's interesting in this church is the fact that the windows aren't hugely different in age, but they're by a number of different artists, and we've got some very different styles that are coming across.
Show me some more, then.
The little details at the bottom, yes, of this window,
okay,
which are dedicated to a stained glass artist.
Ah.
Yes, a really prolific stained glass artist called Nicholson. And I think he was one of three brothers that were involved with this church, because one was an architect, one was responsible for music, and the other was a stained glass artist. So in a way, this church is kind of a memorial to these. This window is created by the artist called Gerald Smith, a very prolific post-war artist who actually worked for Nicholson and took over his practice after he died. And so this is a tribute to him. And we've got the patron saint of stained glass here, James Ulm, on the right. Can you see he's holding sort of welding materials,
yes,
and a cartoon? And then Joan of Arc. These were his two favourite saints. And then the details down here, we can see the monks creating stained glass as they would in the day. And then Nicholson's own studio, where you can see the artists working on creating the cartoons and the drawings and all of the preparatory material. So again, wonderful detailing. And then there's these tiny little details here, either side of the dedication, one of some golf clubs and one of a hand of piquet, which were both Nicholson's favourite pastimes. It's a real tribute, and what it says, to the glory of God and in memory of Archibald Keatley Nicholson, master glass painter who worshipped in this church, this window was designed and carried out by the craftsmen of his studios as a thank offering for his life and friendship. So it's very touching. I just think in all of these windows, you get these little hooks books that are the things that I think pull people in. And even if you don't see it at first, I still think there's something that's pulling you towards the windows, and then they start to reveal.
And now we move over to the north side.
Yeah, so the other chapel that's in here is the Musician's Chapel, only named the Musician's Chapel in, I think, 1946. And it was named that because of Henry Wood, the great founder of the Proms. His ashes are interred here, and he played the organ as a young boy. And his father, I think, was also in the choir. And there is a ceremony at the end of the Proms each year where I believe they come and lay a wreath where his ashes are interred. And I think what's fascinating about this chapel is that there's different glass by different artists, big windows, very close together, so it's quite an amazing explosion of colour overall. But what's so wonderful is that you can get right up close to each of these windows. Normally, windows of this scale, you wouldn't be able to get so close. So if we look in at the middle window, can you see we have Saint Cecilia, who is the patron saint of music. And everything about this window is to do with music. And this is by Gerald Smith again. You always see Saint Cecilia with this crown of roses and lilies around her head. But down at the bottom, we see Henry Wood as a young boy practising on the organ. He was a keen artist as well, so can you see there's a little palette in the middle, and there's also he's wearing his white carnation, which apparently was a big sort of signature. Then we get this remarkable window as a memorial to Dame Nellie Melba, and this is by Brian Thomas, and just look how different the style is. So Nellie Melba was the great celebrated soprano from Melbourne, and she was honoured because of her work during the war. And it was said that a voice like hers would never be heard again. But can you see there's a wonderful sort of cameo portrait of her, and beneath it what looks like a bouquet of flowers that would be given to her at the end of a performance. And then all the way round that cameo portrait are all those trilling golden nightingales. So it's making it very clear that the kind of voice that we're hearing. We've got St. Wilfrid, who was the patron saint of music. He looks as if he's enduring rather than enjoying the music that the angels are playing either side of his head. And then tucked down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's some peaches. She had wonderful desserts made for her by the great chef Escoffier. So Peach Melba, the dessert that we know, is just one of many, but that's named after her. So how great to have peaches tucked in the corner of a window. Her order that was granted to her. Can you see the ribbon with the medal? Then the two major opera houses that she would have performed in, and then her two most famous roles either side. We've got Mimi from Puccini's La Bohème, and we've got Desdemona from Verdi's Otello, two of her great roles. So it's a memorial to her. And there's music everywhere. It's running all the way up the side in lettering. There's a musical score everywhere.
What's it like to perform here?
I mean, it's unpredictable because we don't know who's going to turn up. It's a lunchtime half hour. It's quite a special half hour for people who probably wouldn't expect or plan to go to a concert. And very often we'll be rehearsing here in the morning and people are walking in to see the church and come to see the organ or the musician's chapel. And they happen to see us rehearsing and then they stay for the concert. And that's lovely to have, you know, changed the course of their day to have a little concert. It's a vast space and it's boomy as anything.
Yeah.
So we're lucky that we get to rehearse here because certain things that you have to take into account in the quartet technique of things, you have to sort of alter how you're going to present things because the notes that we can hear that have gone out are coming back at us still because they reverberated back. And they...
Did you know beforehand that this was the musician's church? It had such strong connections with music.
Well, I did. My fiancé actually sings in the choir sometimes and I've been to a couple of their concerts and even songs here. And yeah, I mean, I've always thought it was amazing and loved to play here. and obviously the musicians travel. That's just such a brilliant connection, isn't it?
So you knew.
I did kind of know. Yeah.
But yeah, when our first day here, when we met with the team, gave us a tour and took us into the musicians' chapel. And what a really lovely detail that are these kneelers, cushions in there that have been given in remembrance or stitched in memory of many different musicians. Something else I really like is they roll out this Persian carpet that we take out once a month for our concerts. It's for our cellist, her spike holder. Her spike doesn't slip. But also it soaks up a bit of the resonance for us. Mm. But it also makes it feel like it's our little living room. Right. And that takes it back to the origins of chamber music, really. It's just four people sitting in a room playing and, you know, sharing ideas, and it sort of just makes it like a big living room and people wander in and come listen to you.
Yeah, you don't need a red carpet, no. You've just got a nice little Persian carpet.
Yes.
The music throughout the podcast was performed entirely by the Halcyon Quartet during their lunchtime concert at St Sepulchre Without Newgate, and included Benjamin Britten, 3 Divertimenti, the first movement, Haydn, Opus 74, No. 1, the second movement, Webern, Langsamersatz, Shostakovich String Quartet No. 3, first movement.